There are a lot of things that people have in common. You can meet people on a vacation and you find that they are from the same city you are from, and maybe you're in Europe or you're in Australia and you notice that they have an accent. You sit down with them and you find out, oh yes, I'm also from Lima, Ohio, might be the case with me, or from Akron or Pittsburgh or wherever it may be. And then that opens a door and you talk about other things, because if you have that in common, then you have a lot of things about maybe that city in common. Or you find you meet somebody and they like tennis and you like tennis, or they like golf and you like golf or swimming or some other thing. And maybe other than that, you don't have anything in common. You're not from the same city. You're not the same age. You don't have the same education. You don't have the same background or race or culture. They're from different stratas of income, but you do both, for instance, like the Cleveland Browns. You find that there are people that you will meet here and there who have different things in common. You had the same kind of surgery. You both had open heart surgery, and it has a binding effect. You both like sports cars, or you both went to a certain college. You can name all the kinds of things that would automatically connect you with another human being, and it might be relatively small. But there's one thing that everyone has in common with other people. Every single human being on earth has this in common in one fashion or another, and let me explain it, and that is they are part of a family. They are part of a family. Now, we would see that in even a broader way, because we're part of a church family. I'll talk about that in a moment, in an extraordinary irony that ties directly into the sermon. But this is a sermon, and it's about the family, not about marriage, not about child rearing, which both are parts of the family, but this is actually a sermon about the family. And I wanted to give it before the feast that they can appreciate its overarching connection to the very feast itself, although it's indirect. Now, we're in the process of producing a brochure. We think it's the last brochure we're going to publish. It's, in a sense, a prophetic trend report, and it's going to be on the subject of the family. It's going to be pretty thick. And as a matter of fact, a lot of what you're hearing in this very sermon will be in that brochure, among the other component parts. Now, back to the family. Circumstances differ, obviously. No two families are exactly alike. I guess you could conceivably have a husband and wife that have a 6-year-old boy and a 4-year-old girl. I'm not saying that it's not possible that that could be alike, but where they live, the other nature of the extended family around it, how many aunts and uncles and cousins, and the age of the parents and so forth, there are going to be differences. I don't care which two families you pick on planet Earth, I'll show you families with differences. So in the broad sense, we have a family in common, in that we are all part of a family. In the even broader sense, all human beings have in common that they know everybody else is in the greater family of humanity. But other than that, it's different. The immediate family can be different. The extended family can be different. We even have the term, of course, extended family. We have the term nuclear family because there's so many goofed up families today coming off of the nuclear family, which is another way of saying goofed up families, because it can mean a lot of things. You also have the term biological family. An orphan would talk in terms of maybe his biological parents, but he wouldn't think of them as his real parents, because his real parents would be those who reared him. Unless he grew up in an orphanage, then he really is part of a different kind of family. But chances are he lived with different families, so he would even have a certain family in common. I was watching some years ago, watching NBC News, I remember very well, a case of a woman in Valdosta, Georgia, who had a baby. She was 16 years old, so maybe we should call her a teenager. She's far from womanhood at age 16. But here she was, and they focused on this picture, and she was sitting there, and there was her mother, which would be the baby's grandmother. there was her mother's father, which would be her great-grandfather, I believe it was, and then her mother's father's mother, which would be her great-great-grandmother, and even her mother's father's mother's mother's mother, the third great-grandmother, all sitting in the same picture. Six generations. I've never seen that. And the age range between them would have had to have been, because of the age of the great-great-great-grandmother, was, I figured out, approximately 20, 19, 18, 17, and 16 years. Now, it might have varied, but you actually had those generations. I think I said it right. I think there'd be six different generations in that picture. A mathematician calculated that to have six generations, at least in this age, it wouldn't be so in Adam's time. You could have far more than that, many more than that. But the odds of six generations being alive and able to be in one picture, and this one in Valdosta, Georgia, was 600 million to one. So you could even have a family that looked like that, and then how far beyond that might the family go, just beyond the six that made it into the picture? It just boggles the mind. I remember a lady in Syracuse who was about, I believe she was about 89 years old, something like that. And she got a personal letter from Jimmy Carter, and she brought it up to me. She said, "Oh, Mr. Pack, I got a personal letter." And it was a personal letter from Jimmy Carter. It was not hand-stamped, and it was signed. And it was because she had so many grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. I remember that by the time you added her grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren, I don't think she had any triple greats. She was, again, she was 89 years old, so it wasn't 105 or 108. I saw a woman, sat next to a woman who was, I think, 106 one time. It was her birth there. I think she was 108. She was only 89, but she had all these direct descendants from her. And they totaled in the 80s, not counting who they married. It was an astonishing thing. I mean, and so that had somehow made its way to the president. And on her birthday, President Carter sent her, and it was about 1979 or something, sent her this card. Well, there are all kinds of good circumstances that can be common to families. There are obviously terrible circumstances. And in this age, really terrible and growing worse almost daily. Every conceivable kind of problem that's common to human beings are found in families, because all human beings are in families, and so those problems find their way not just into individual lives, but into families, and they create problems and difficulties. Now, Mr. Armstrong said something profound, many things profound, obviously, but said something that I never thought about until he said it, and he said, "A nation, an entire nation, is merely a family grown large." Now, for a long time, I've enjoyed studying my genealogy and looking at my background. I'll probably come back to that a little bit later. My wife has kind of gotten the bug. And she's connected with her family in a very coherent way back to 1740, and cousins and third and 23rd cousins and everything else going all different directions. And my wife is, I think, related probably to about two-thirds of the people on Earth at this point from what I'm seeing. And she's even got connections back to the year 1000, where her family was in the year 1000, over 1,000 years ago. And she's learned that in recent weeks. Now, I'll come back to that, but it's interesting looking at the characteristics, the physical characteristics of the family. She was showing me a picture that somebody sent her this morning of her, I wish I could remember, the man who had her father's name, I think his name was Peter Oakes, and he had 14 children. It was a picture when he was in the Austrian Hungary Army, and the picture was taken in 1900, 105 years ago, and I'm telling you, looking right at that picture this morning, it struck me, I've got a son who looks exactly like his grandfather, Peter Oakes, in the eyes, and looks almost stunning how much our second son looks like his grandpa Oakes, and those eyes, my wife and I instantly saw our son's eyes in this fellow's eyes, who also happened to have the same name as his grandfather, but just going back a couple more generations. Amazing. I guess it would be my son's great-great-grandfather. I'm not sure if I've got that right, with the same name as his grandfather. And characteristics can last for centuries. Well, you can study the tribes of Israel and what God said they would be like. The French are exactly like God said millennia ago, coming off of Reuben's conduct. There you're talking about conduct, not necessarily looks. Unstable as water. Look at France. Guess what? It's right. They're unstable as water. And so characteristics in either physical looks will stay the same, changing obviously in specific ways, but staying the same in a general way. Nature will stay, like the French. Or sons of Ishmael. God said the Arabs would be wild people. Ishmael is a wild man. Look at the Arabs today. Do you doubt it? All you have to do is look at the bombings that occurred on Wednesday and Thursday, and the death of hundreds of innocent people by homicide bombers who also took their own lives, but they're more properly called homicide bombers. And it's astounding, the nature of people who will just drive into a crowd of people looking for a job and blow them all up. We can't comprehend that here. No doubt we will someday experience it here. And we already have, the people who got their hands on the steering wheel of jets. But in the end, it's difficult for us to comprehend, but it's a very natural thing in the Middle East for people who are from any of the 12 sons of Ishmael. All right. Now, if you look, though, also at the physical characteristics, I mean, I look at my great-grandfather, and actually great-great-grandfather, picture of my great-great-grandfather Johnston, and I know where I got my ears. My son's got them. And so that, I don't know how many generations, I'm trying to think if my grandchildren have them. I don't know, but they're probably too little to know yet. But my first son came out, wow, the ears were right there. And I couldn't believe it from the moment of birth, practically. And it's just, it passes on, and there it is. You know, you can see things that as you get older and look more like your grandparents, because you knew your grandparents when they're older, but by the time you're older, they're gone, you find yourself starting to look like your grandparents and thinking about them. You know, I look in the mirror now and I think, wow, my dad's not dead at all. He's right there. And at times, and I feel like I look like my father. My brother was saying the same thing. So you have all kinds of characteristics within families that bind you, other than just you know them or you carry their name. You might have certain nature, and you might have certain physical characteristics, and God designed it so. Animals are the same. It's amazing, really. I mean, I don't know horses, but I watch people who know horses, particularly racehorses, and they'll talk about how a colt that came from a great racehorse, oh, he has his father's shoulders. I can't tell that. Just look at horse's shoulders to me. He has his mother's face or the mare's face or something. Are they making it up? I don't know. Because none of the rest of us could know. They could make it up and we wouldn't know. Or it could be true. It could be true. I certainly can tell that a dog, particularly if it comes from two different kinds of dogs, radically different kinds of dogs, not so much a purebred. The purebred puppy looks like the parents, and you'd have to know purebreds to say, oh, it looks just like the purebred parents. Of course it does. They're dachshunds, and it's a dachshund. That's the way I'd look at it. But if it comes from a dachshund and a Saint Bernard, I could probably see elements of both. Hopefully the dachshund wasn't the mother, or it'd be a motherless puppy. The childbirth would be enough to kill the puppy. Or puppy birth, I guess it wouldn't be childbirth. So a lot of us can appreciate certain ways that animals look like their parents. I wouldn't want to be around a full-grown lion, but I can tell a cute little lion cub, it somehow is radically different as it is, at about 3 pounds, 4 pounds, you can tell it's going to grow up to look like a 700-pound full-grown African lion. It just has the same, a little roly-poly lion cub, and so forth. God made it so. God made it so. Well, the Bible is loaded with examples of good and bad families. Families that God blesses, families that God curses. Sometimes for generations. He even says he'll do it to the third and fourth generation in some cases. Others could be cursed for thousands of years. Canaan, for instance, because of what he did to Grandpa Noah. But it also is loaded with examples of good and bad in families. So you might think of it two ways. The Bible is loaded with examples of good and bad families, and it's loaded with examples of good and bad in families. David would represent, we could say, a good family. He had Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived. Solomon did some bad things. Others of David's children did bad things, but you overall would maybe say it was a good family. Certainly a mix, I guess. There was bad in the family. That's my point. You have a good family with bad problems or a bad person, a bad family from which would emerge a good person or a righteous king. Stop and think about the kings, for instance. Just evil kings, righteous kings, evil, evil, righteous, righteous, or even three evils and a righteous, or whatever it was, the kings of Israel and Judah. Well, obviously, for each one of the righteous kings, there was a point where one of them, many of them, came from an evil king. It's possible. And if you have evil kings, you go back far enough, there would have been one, if there were two or three in a row, that came from a righteous king. So you're not going to automatically be like your family in character or nature in any way. You may or may not look like them. I've seen people who don't look at all like a parent. I remember Orville Redenbacher. Oh, you remember Orville Redenbacher? Remember the commercials, the popcorn guy and his grandson? That grandson looked more like Orville Redenbacher than Orville Redenbacher looked. It was unbelievable, and he was a grandson. And yet, I've got a son who doesn't look anything like his mother, and she'd be the first to say, but I saw where he came from, so I know she's the mother. And he admits it, we all admit it, and she says, well, he's got my one tooth that looks the same or something, you know, and she kids about the teeth, but that's about it. But yet we think he has a daughter that sort of looks like grandma, so it jumped over him and landed in a granddaughter. Now, turn to Matthew chapter 10. Let's look at an interesting paradox, a very interesting paradox. Matthew chapter 10 and verse 34. Now, verse 32 might be good to pick it up. Whosoever therefore shall confess me before men, him will I confess also before my Father which is in heaven. Whosoever shall deny me before men, will I deny before my Father. Verse 34. Think not, now coming off of this is fascinating. If we had more time, we could look at the whole chapter. It's fascinating that Christ put in this chapter this subject. If you want to really appreciate what we're about to read, take the time to read the whole chapter. And as you do, try to figure out, keep asking yourself, why is what we're about to read in this chapter? You'll learn some interesting things. Verse 34 seems to almost change the subject, but it really doesn't. Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. Now, you could sort of see a connection without reading much of the rest of the chapter. If you just look there, well, okay, I could have to deny God, and that could alleviate a sword, or I could confess Christ, and then that could cause me problems with the people I'm confessing him to. So maybe that would create a sword in my life in a certain way. But what's it exactly talking about? Verse 35. Christ makes absolutely plain what he's talking about, and where sometimes our biggest problems come up in the Church of God in who we will or will not confess Christ to. It's talking about family that God isn't calling. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father. That's an astonishing statement. I came to split families. Does that mean Christ came literally with the goal, the purpose, to split husbands and wives and fathers and sons and mothers and daughters and brothers and sisters? No. But the net effect of obeying him is that that's exactly what would happen. I've come and I call individuals and families. God doesn't call whole extended families. He just doesn't do it. I've seen a lot of times where they all tumbled into the church after a strong matriarch and patriarch that leads the family, but invariably they break up and leave because God doesn't do that. He just doesn't do it. And we learned that in the apostasy. all right, and a mother against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes shall be they of his own household. All right, I said there's an irony here. The irony is this. Not until you come into the church of God and you learn the truth do you learn the purpose of the family. Why God made families, husbands, wives, children. I recently, over the last week or so, and even quite a bit this morning for a couple more hours, just reading over the book on sex and going over the parallels, because the purpose and reasons for the family and how it parallels what God is doing are so profound and are tied directly into the hidden or missing dimension in sex. So I was going over it, and just it's fascinating how all of that comes together. I guess as I was reading my own words there, it just is amazing. God is all for the family. He designed the family. And yet Christ said he came and the family is split as a result of his calling. All right, now back to my point. We're called and we learn this marvelous divine purpose for the family. We learned why it exists, why we have parents, that there's even a whole commandment that is commanded, the fifth commandment, to honor those parents, whether in or out of the church. And yet at the very same time we are learning about how to have wholesome, happy, healthy, wonderful families, the very first thing that happens as we're learning that is our family gets split by a sword because we're called. It's an irony that's extraordinary. Now, as you're ready to learn how to be a better son, a better daughter, a better parent, a better husband or wife or brother or sister, and you're learning how important it is, they hate you and in some cases throw you right out of the family. And anything you had in common with them, as far as they're concerned, is over because you won't put up a Christmas tree with them in 2 months or 6 months or 1 week. Or I've had people, they learn a week before Christmas that Christmas is wrong. They read the Christmas booklet. You can read the Christmas booklet for the first time in January and have a year to prepare, or you can read it on December 18th and have a week to prepare. It depends on when you pick it up and how long you have to get ready, and it can create major problems because in a week it's almost impossible to read that booklet and learn how to handle all the nuances of Christmas with a family that has probably already put the tree up. You might have even helped them decorate it when they did. I remember telling my parents I wasn't going to participate in Christmas, and I just turned to 18 years old, and that did not fly well, I will tell you, but with my mother. It was a big thing to her, and it created problems, and I didn't handle it well. I don't have time to tell you how I handled it, but I do remember pushing the Christmas booklet at her rather vigorously, and she rather vigorously resisted as my mother could. All right. So God is not against the family, but many of God's people, of course, have to learn, as I gave in a sermon, I don't know, was it a year and a half ago maybe, maybe at least that long, which family comes first. The Bible talks about your physical family, talks about a spiritual family, and many, many places Christ talks about which family, the one you are baptized into, the body of Christ, and all the other body parts, does that come first, or your human family? And it's obvious now, if you just think about what I said a moment ago, how we had better confess God's way in front of our physical family, which is where the greatest test invariably arises, and where most people will collapse because they need the support structure of the family, and God designed it so, and yet with His Spirit, we have to be prepared to go it alone and watch a sword. The biggest sword you can possibly imagine comes slashing right through the family and, in essence, cutting you out of it. There's been an assault on the family unlike any other time in history. And we're going to look at the subject of the family over the remainder of the sermon in detail. And I was just listening to the news, I believe it was Wednesday night, it might have been Thursday night, it was very recently, about just the value of families that eat at least 5 meals together at dinner. National news. It was ABC News. And it was extraordinary. Somebody did a survey of the value of eating a meal where the whole family is sitting around the table at least 5 times a week, an evening meal, a dinner meal. Didn't address lunch, which would probably be at school or work or whatever, and didn't address breakfast. Just talking about 5 dinners per week for 15 to 20 minutes. What was the effect on the children? One of the most stunning statistics I think I've ever heard, having to do with the family. 42% less likelihood for children in such homes to even try alcohol while they're underage, just because they have those meals and feel a bond in the family. 59% less likely to try drugs, and 66% less likely to even try marijuana, which so many kids try today. Why? Now, I'm sure there are other factors, but how powerful is the family? Among all other factors, you have statistics that high for alcohol, drugs, and marijuana if they just eat, you know, a little over 70%, 5/7, I guess would be 71% if you're a mathematician, of their evening meals together. Astounding. Absolutely astounding. Now, of course, on the other side of things, here's an article from the Washington Times. Single adult households have displaced two-parent families with children as the most common kind of U.S. household. This article, entitled More Homes in U.S. Go Solo, begins. It's breathtaking how many people still think that the mom, pop, and two kids is the majority of households, said Peter Francese, the founder of American Demographics magazine. And the article essentially goes on and talks about how the family's been blown away as we know it. This one article. Nuclear family households, two married parents and a child, were the most common as recently as 1990, when there were 25 million such households. By 2000, nuclear family households fell to second place, both because there were almost a half a million fewer of these types of homes and because the number of single adult households surged past 27 million. Married households without children remained the third most common, with 20 million in 1990 and 22 in 2000. And so forth. So it's fascinating what they're predicting will be the situation by 2010. They'll be just really, as a nation, and nations are only as strong as their family. If a nation is a family grown large, then nations are defined by how many families they have within it that remain as God intended. Then the nation is doomed based on that one point alone. Incredible how many people now are dysfunctional. We talk about the term dysfunctional families. I was listening the other day to all the kinds of disorders people have because families are so fouled up. They have no support system. They have no stability, no framework, no foundation on which to just stand, face life, and be reasonably normal. Because they're surrounded in part by miserable families and then experts telling them that they have disorders. There are all kinds of new disorders. There's what's called adjustment disorder. And of course, healthcare plans and healthcare providers are under siege by more and more people telling them, I'm sick because this expert said I have early female arousal disorder. I'm sorry, that is one. I have caffeine disorder. I have sleep disorder. I have attention deficit disorder. I have attention hyperdeficit disorder. One half of all people in the United States, largely attributed to the fact that they never got grounded in a sound family environment, it's now estimated that one half of all human beings in the United States will get a mental disorder. And of course, as people get weaker and the number of different types of disorders are defined and categorized and cataloged in such a way that somebody say, you've got that. And then they're saying people will have multiple disorders. There'll be so many different kinds of disorders. And whether people have them or not, somebody will be telling them they have them. And in such combinations, it's like taking medicines. This medicine won't hurt you in this way, it'll hurt you in that way, this one this way and that way, but if you take them in combination, nobody really knows what medicines do, other than the smart people know they're getting poisoned. because the side effects can compound. Well, these disorders are going to compound in people who, if they don't have them, after they've heard experts tell them they have disorder A, B, and C, and X, Y, and Z, and so forth, they're going to have them at the end. They'll go away so nutty, talking in such psychobabble, that they won't know how to cope. And as one man said, soon every human quirk, this is an exact quote, I wrote it down, will be considered a mental disorder. How dysfunctional is America? It's as dysfunctional as the family. And of course, is it any wonder then that this week, just 2 days ago, out came this article, and it's directly attributed to the fact that families are not bonding. This particular survey I opened with about the drugs, alcohol, and marijuana didn't talk about how active kids would be sexually if they did or didn't have a strong family, but I'll guarantee you what I'm about to read to you comes straight back to the strength or the weakness of families. And all of the families of God's church have got to understand this. One half of all teenagers by their mid-teen years in America are engaging in oral sex, and 70% altogether once you get up to 18 and 19, and believing that they are virgins because nobody's teaching them. Sex education is creating that kind of problem, which always leads them into further sexual experimentation, which creates more illegitimate babies or abortions, and all kinds of additional goofed up families, because people are now in vast numbers, tens and scores of thousands of kids in middle school practicing this. And facts coming out so stunning that conditions 10 years ago seem like they were 500 years ago, as the world changes at veritable warp speed. And families simply can't cope. They can't keep up with what's slamming into them at incredible speed. Things that nobody's ever seen before. I liken what's happened to the family to Katrina. Now the government and everybody's playing the blame game because of what happened with Katrina. Truth is, nobody could possibly be ready for a Category 4 striking a metropolitan area of 1.5 million, never mind Mississippi and Alabama, where 35-foot wall of water, storm surge goes 2 miles inland with sustained winds at 175 miles an hour. FEMA couldn't know it. The world's never seen anything like that. 4 times more homes destroyed than Andrew. Never mind all of the businesses that were destroyed and the veritable Marshall Plan the president announced on Thursday night of $200 million, which he wants to pull off, oh, by the way, without a tax increase. Why? Because politicians have to solve problems or they get voted out. He knows if he doesn't give the people what they want, which is return New Orleans to the way it was, and you can't imagine what I read in yesterday's paper, the mayor of New Orleans said, we want New Orleans exactly the way it was. The same mystique, the same uniqueness that made New Orleans, only bigger and better. Did anybody learn from Katrina's wake-up call? I think not, said Mayor Ray Nagin. You know, he didn't say that part. He said the part before it. Well, nobody could be ready for a tsunami the size of the one in late December. Nobody is ready for the kinds of things that are striking the family. And what is destroying the family is simply destroying America. Sin is a reproach to any people, the Bible says, and if you really wanted to summarize what's happening to the family today, it would be good to just consider it sin. I mean, well, that's what's happening to families. They're being destroyed by sin of every kind. It goes on and on and on and on. 83% of all marriages in the United States and the Western world, 83%, one of the partners is cheating on the other. That's 5 out of 6. And I guess everybody assumes that none of the kids can tell who's kidding whom. All right. I want to give 7 points. I don't normally give sermons with points, but this one is a little unusual. They all have to do with the family. The first one is to parents. Point one is to parents. And at times I'll be speaking directly to children. I hope the parents will listen in. Other times I'll be speaking directly to parents. Obviously, the children need to listen in. But point two will be to children and teens. Point three will be to parents. Point four will be to children and teens. Point five will be to parents. Point six will be to children and teens. And point seven will be to families as a whole. So, in a sense, that's who I'm speaking to as these points go every other number. Number one, speaking to parents. And there's so many things that could be said, let's face it. You know, we've written a long book on the subject, and there's much more that could be said, I suppose, that wasn't in that book. I think it covers all the basic principles well, but there's other things. But point number one to parents, of only three that are directly to parents, and it's so important, teach your children their proper roles in life. Teach them their proper roles in life. Look at Proverbs 20, Proverbs chapter 20. An extraordinary verse, a very simple verse, and yet there's so much in it. The glory of young men is their strength, and the beauty of old men is the gray head. Of all the things the Bible could have talked about, it talks about boys having physically strong bodies. Now, I don't think there's a boy that's ever existed that didn't stand in front of a mirror and wish that he saw Arnold Schwarzenegger staring back at him, you know, that he'd be the Terminator. Boys go through periods where, you know, they look, they make a bicep and it looks like there's a pea trapped under their skin in each arm, and they don't want anybody to see that, so they check and hope that slowly it'll grow to be the size of a marble, and then eventually, you know, a golf ball and whatever else. And everybody wants to be strong, but a lot of people are not taught there's value in strength. You know, I've often thought about Abraham Lincoln, perhaps the greatest human leader in many regards, perhaps for 500 years, maybe one of the greatest, maybe the greatest human leader who ever existed. I don't know. I mean, who knows how to define those things? He's considered the greatest democratic leader that's ever existed. I don't just mean in this country. Most people don't realize, because he was slender, he was an immensely powerful human being. And there's a tie to that. You know, he could stand and hold a double-bladed axe with each hand for 1 minute, nonstop, straight out. They called him the rail splitter. You know, a lot of kids today would die if they held a pencil or a golf ball or a golf club. You know, I used to do that as a kid. We'd hold a golf ball or a golf club. I'm sorry, not a golf ball. Golf club. Golf ball's fairly easy, although he could stand there, and he was on. His nickname was Honest Abe, so I assume he told the truth. When he was reported, and others reported it to him, yet he was relatively thin. He didn't look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. But it's part of the male role. Now, on the other hand, I've seen, if any of you ever seen, you don't have to raise your hands, a bodybuilding contest where you pop in on one, and here are female bodybuilders. And I saw one many years ago. I've seen several. I've picked up magazines and seen pictures of looks like a woman's face, some of them attractive, but got transplanted onto the Incredible Hulk's body. It's unbelievable. This one woman I saw in this contest, and she was up there flexing, and all the guys were catcalling and whistling. It was sickening, absolutely sickening. She looked humongous and probably shot full of steroids. And I would much rather, I'd much rather face the Terminator than that woman. And yet, you know, she's a pretty lady, very attractive. And RoboCop or something, if you remember that movie. That was another one I remember, just terrifying to look at. I sure hope, you know, she's not married to Don Knotts. I feel for Don Knotts. Some of you probably don't know who Don Knotts is. But as the beauty of old men is the gray head. Fellas, you're going to lose 1% of your muscle mass every year after age 25. It's just going to start to fade. By the time you get to age 50, you will have lost about 25%. After age 50, you start losing 2% of your muscle mass per year. You wonder why people look very, very thin and frail when they're much older. It's because the muscle mass disappears. But what God does then is he replaces it with a different strength, and it's the hoary head, you know, the gray head of wisdom. But the glory of young men is their strength, later on it gets replaced. Now, 1 Peter chapter 3, 1 Peter 3, verse 7. Likewise, you husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge. Obviously, you're speaking of wives. Giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel. All right, these bodybuilders aside, they were talking about their weaker vessel. Now, women are stronger than men in some ways. They have a higher threshold of pain and need it. God designed it so. They often have to save children in trouble and go through different kinds of things that men maybe don't. They have certain strengths men don't have, for sure. But overall, I mean, let's face it. Men can put on much more muscle. They're much stronger than women. They are weaker vessels. And as being heirs together, the grace of life, and there's an interesting statement, that your prayers be not hindered. Answered prayers, and of course, prayers that are uttered in faith, which if they weren't would be hindered for sure, are affected. If there is not a right understanding of the roles in marriage, where the man recognizes, I am physically more powerful than my wife, which means I'm automatically, to some degree, her protector. That's why it's such a vile thing. Mr. Armstrong had a standing statement. If any man ever beat his wife up, you disfellowship him and then ask questions later. You don't even ask any questions until the man understands that he's been told he's out of the church. Now let's talk about it. If you want to talk about how to come back to church, we'll talk about how to come back to church, but we're not going to dignify the subject by telling you there's any chance you can be a part of the church of God if you beat your wife up because she's a weaker vessel. I've been involved in many, many marriage counselings where the man struck his wife. And, of course, it happens all the time in the world. There's battered women. There's all kinds of problems that are one of the reasons families become so dysfunctional. Little boys are not taught, they protect, starting their little sisters. I had a big sister who quickly was a little sister. You know, and I guess for a little while she was bigger than me, but I shot right past her. She's not a very big woman at all. And my dad made me kind of watch out for her. By the time I was about four, I had to kind of watch out for my five-year-old sister, a little more than a year older than me. My dad trained me to think that way. And so little boys, if they're taught that they're bigger and stronger and there's a responsibility, you think that way. You just do. And, of course, then it's easy to transfer over to a marriage where, obviously, not only will you treat a wife as a weaker vessel and the roles tend to be cemented, she's taught, wait a minute, I'm not as strong. Don't try to take the lead. I'm not the head of the home. I'm to submit and yield because there's other things that come off of far different than strength. I'm just trying to pick a point of this so you can understand the radical differences. And then, of course, that same father and mother will be teaching other little people that they are producing the same thing and it gets perpetuated. And healthy families flow as a result of understanding there are roles. Somebody's in charge, somebody's not. Somebody does most of the child rearing because of their home. Somebody doesn't. Somebody generally does the breadwinning. Somebody doesn't. You understand? We understand who the somebodies are. Now, of course, having physical strength, as long as we're talking about it for a moment, bullying has become a major problem across the United States and really in the West. I guess, what do they call it in Britain? Slap happy, where you go up and you just go up to strangers in school and you slap them hard, just hard, and just terrorize kids or strangers in a subway or whatever, just to create fun. Sounds like a lot of fun, right? But, you know, if you teach your sons, dads, to be physically strong, much less likely anybody's going to pick on them because of, for instance, religious differences. I'm glad I was big. I just don't like it when I bump my head and other people wouldn't. I don't like it when I pay more for clothes or have to fit into a car like a pretzel. It's designed for, you know, somebody who's normal size. No, I don't like that, but in a way I'm kind of glad I'm big because it reminds me of the importance of a certain amount of physical strength. Height doesn't attach to strength, but I tried to stay strong. My father, I was blessed. His father wanted me to be strong, taught me about it. He wasn't in the church. But it's very, very important that you teach your kids to be strong. My dad sat me down. I mean, he told me in no uncertain terms how to defend myself. I'm sure he'd do it differently. Later on, he even apologized in a way for the way he did it when God called and converted him. But you know, you need to teach your sons to be physically strong and to not back away when somebody comes at them, but to try to be wise and just to protect a little sister. Also had a little brother, much younger and smaller, and I remember, wasn't very old. My dad told me I had to kind of watch out for him too. I'm glad of that. You need to teach your children the same thing, parents. Teach your children their roles. Your love for each other will be witnessed by your children, and they will tend to be comfortable in the role they see naturally carried out above them for a couple decades, and they'll automatically, if the old saying can be used here, monkey see, monkey do, and they will. They will try to copy it. The world will sort of change the way it puts it, kind of programs children. I remember first grade, I heard boys were snakes and snails and puppy dog tails, and little girls were sugar and spice and everything nice, and girls were a little sweeter in some ways. I'd watch them, they'd come into class and they'd bring the apples to the teachers and whatever else, and I remember thinking when I was young, I wonder if there's a connection between some of the grades they're getting that I'm not getting. I remember thinking that first, second, and third grade, literally. But those kinds of things are programmed into kids. That's unhealthy. Now today, girls can be very different. Some of the gangs I'm going to be talking about here in a moment, astonishing. To join certain gangs in the United States, a girl is put in a car and taught to be tough, and she's told, now we're going to throw the door open, and when that door's thrown open, you shoot the person dead when we pass them, understand? And a lot of girls are told, you want to be in a gang with us? You have to demonstrate the willingness to run over and kill a person and back over them again. If you just run over them once and panic and leave, you can't be in the gang. You have to back over this poor, helpless person with 4,000 pounds of vehicle and be sure they're dead, then we'll take you into the gang. Reading an article many years ago, actually. I could quote it for you. I've got it right up here from USA Today cover story. That was going on in gangs in the late 80s and early 90s in Los Angeles. Here's an article. Here it is. Gangs run wild. That's an article from 1989. I've got a lot of newer ones, obviously. We'll come back to gangs a little bit later. All right. Boys are different than girls. I mean, let's just understand that you will program your children a certain way, and little girls will tend to go looking for a daddy like their own. So then, what kind of daddy are they seeing? Little boys will often go looking for a mommy. Whether it should or shouldn't, it tends to happen like their own. So what kind of mommy are they seeing? They're different. They're different. We had boys 22 months apart, and we didn't think we wanted to have a third child. We thought, well, we'll get a boy and girl. Didn't turn out that way. And we got these two boys, and they were very close, and we thought, wow, we don't have four. Because we thought if we have a third child and the years were passing, that child will be alone. But we wanted a girl. And my wife read this book and said, I think we do this. We might get a girl. And there's a few this's and that's in there. For 2 years, neither one of us wanted another child. Then for 2 years, I wanted one and my wife didn't. And for 2 years, she wanted one and I didn't. Finally, we decided, okay, we do want one because she found this book. Everybody said, oh, Mr. Pack, all these years, boys are different than girls. Boy, I said, yeah, sure, And I'd been programmed, and then I had one. It's true. It's very true. So, all right. Teach those differences. Teach them their roles. Number two, children and teens. Remember to be loyal to your family name. Remember to be loyal to your family name, Proverbs 19 and verse 26. This morning I went back and listened to this sermon I gave, 14 years ago, I think, over in Toledo. listening to some of the stories about my children I had forgotten about. I normally don't listen to a sermon again if I've given it before. This time I did. And just remembering some of these different stories. I don't know if I'll even have time to tell them all. I'm running behind here. But Proverbs 19 and verse 26 says, "He that wastes his father and chases away his mother is a son that causes shame and brings reproach." Every family potentially has a black sheep. We do. You do, I'm sure. Grandpa Pack he was an unusual person. Let's just say that he lived a different kind of life. But other than that, it's been fun to study my family. I've gone all the way back to my seventh great grandfather to check the Pack name, for instance. I wanted my children to understand where they came from, and I found my seventh great grandfather, George Pack, came from the southern coast of England, from Plymouth, was fleeing religious persecution. He was a Presbyterian, and I know where he settled. I found where he settled in New Jersey. I actually have his oath of allegiance to King Charles II that he uttered, I think, in 1665, I think. I'm not sure. And as one of the first 80 settlers of New Jersey. That's fun. I took my kids around through graveyards. I wanted them to have a sense of where they came from. And I think it took. There's so much that we learned. My wife, as I mentioned earlier, having a ball studying her family. And you can learn a lot about your roots. I mean, Princess Di, when she was alive, of course, she did, Princess Diana, remember her? She's called Princess Di. She's related to three presidents. Well, now you'd have to say four, because she was related to George Bush, and now she'd be obviously related to his son, George Bush 41 and George Bush 43, and she's English, and they've connected it sufficiently to know that she is related to four different presidents. So George Bush, the president today, knows that he is a distant relative of Princess Diana. Kind of interesting. And Ronald Reagan, by the way, was one of the ones she was related to. She related to the Bushes and the Reagans, and Bush and Reagan were, president and vice president. Fascinating. You learn names. I found that I had a second great-grandfather who was killed at Gettysburg on the first day of battle. I knew his name was R. Lower. It looked like lower, L-O-W-E-R. And I wanted to find that gravestone, so we marched into the cemetery there, and I found it. And it said Lieutenant Randall Lower. And I thought, Randall, his name was Randall. And I had named my son Randall, but I did it because my dad was named Randall. His father had a middle name Randall. My brother's middle name was Randall. I thought, wow, a lot of Randalls. I even have a girl cousin named Randy with an I. But I didn't know where it came from. I'm standing in Gettysburg and looking down at this stone and seeing this guy who was about 22 years old, named Randall Lower. I have a picture of his mother. Well, I tell those stories to my kids, and now all of a sudden it has more meaning, doesn't it? You have the family name. Turn to Ephesians chapter 3. We can bring shame and reproach on that name. Teach your children that they can. And children, recognize you have to be loyal to that name. That name has been carried for a long time. Alex Haley made that plain when he told that fascinating story of Roots. I ought to pull that out and just listen to it again sometime. It was so fascinating to me to watch Roots. I remember, Kunta Kinte, I found you, I found you. Now, some of you may be too young to really remember that, but that was quite a moment. Was it James Earl Jones, I think, who found this relative from West Africa, who was the first to be brought here into slavery, if you know the story. Okay, again, Ephesians 3. It says here, "For this cause I bow my knees unto the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, of whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named." Now look, brethren, we learned at baptism we carry the Father's name. We come to the Father in Christ's name. God tells us all kinds of different names that He has, which when you translate them to English, some people get hung up, you have to say them in Hebrew, which serves to diminish God's name. Unless you speak Hebrew, then it's fine. But God has all kinds of things that He reveals in His names. Yahweh Rofika, God our healer. That's part of his name. You know, Mekadishkem and Nisai and Adonai, and well, just so many different names that God has that all bring meaning. And when we carry his name, in a sense, we carry all of those names. We also carry a certain human name. And you can be a big ink spot in your family genealogy. You know, you can look into every family genealogy, a family tree, as they say. Don't look too close in your family tree or you'll find somebody hanging in it. You know, and that's true. But there are family histories and traditions. Pass them on to your children. Children absorb them. Recognize you are coming into a certain heritage. It was picked for you. And you are responsible for carrying that name high. You hurt more than yourself, young people, if you drag your family name in the mud. I'm speaking directly to you. As young as you can be to understand this, recognize that. There's much in a name. There's much in a name. We understand we carry the name Philadelphia, for instance. That means we had better reflect brotherly love. Or we are dishonoring the name Christ has given us. We understand what Laodicea means, and so forth. It's very important to recognize there is a certain value in your genealogy. Now, people can go too far. They can go, you know, endless genealogies. The Bible warns about that, and you get hung up in it. But it's fascinating, and it can give you a sense of your place in history. It can bring a certain rounding to you, a certain balance, a certain humility. Flows from understanding where you came from for generations. It tends to reduce you in a good way. You see yourself as something part of a bigger event. It was just a joy last night to watch my wife talk to her older sister about all this stuff she's been learning. It was like two kids in a candy shop. And the husband just sat there and listened. It was fascinating to listen. And my wife, I'm sure, is far from done. I remember the feeling. I'll be the last guy to slow her down. I want all of our children to appreciate what she learns as well. All right, number three, point number three, to parents. Be sure that you can, will, and always do understand your children. Understand them. Psalm 103 and verse 13. You know, the great hue and cry of youth. You don't understand me. Now, that's often an excuse. And if they can claim that they're not understood, they can justify their actions or portray themselves as victims. You can mitigate that by focusing on them, empathizing with them, sympathizing with them, recognizing that what you went through may or may not apply to what they are going through. The world is changing so rapidly that my childhood, I'm in my mid, moving toward late 50s, my childhood is so radically different, not just from my children, but my grandchildren, five grandchildren now, it's almost incomprehensible. And the people who say today, and you've heard me say this in other sermons, oh, I understand, I remember what it was like, forget it, you don't understand, it's different. It's totally different. Drugs are everywhere. Promiscuity is everywhere. Drugs to me were at the drugstore, something you were prescribed to take. Today, it's everywhere. Teenage alcoholism is rampant. Teenage gambling is rampant. Pornography bombarding kids because of an internet that didn't exist when my kids were adults, never mind kids today, or when my kids were children, never mind kids today, bombarding kids. Easy access to pay-per-view trash on television. I never saw an adult bookstore when I was young. Maybe they existed. They certainly didn't exist anywhere I went. I never even drove by one. I don't remember any kind of concept of it. Today, they're out on the highway. They're everywhere. But they're almost passé because the world is so drenched in junk and kids are exposed to it. The wise parent will understand what their kids are enduring, what they're exposed to. Psalm 103 and verse 13. Like as a father pities his children, so the Lord pities them that fear him. For he knows our frame. He remembers that we're dust. He remembers. He understands us. He'll say, I'm God. You know, I don't have to understand you. I'm God. No, he remembers. He is a father. Like a father pities his children. And I would add, like a father is supposed to pity his children, meaning empathize and sympathize. Of course, Malachi 4, 5, and 6 says, one of our responsibilities is to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children to the fathers. One of the reasons psychologists are thriving today with all kind of pop psychobabble junk is that they're being presented with all kinds of problems. And because it's an industry and it's a way to make money, become an expert, have people listen to you when you don't have a hint, inkling, or clue what you're talking about, but you've got certain letters after your name, PhD or master's or whatever else, then you spew stuff back and it becomes a complicating formula that has all of society thinking in terms of psychology instead of right and wrong. You have to teach your children about right and wrong, and that's, of course, not a lot of room here in the sermon for that, but let me just tell you, you have to teach them about right and wrong. You have to understand them, but you have to connect the things they're going through to whether they did right or did wrong. The wise parent will always make the connection. All right, you're feeling this. You've suffered that. The other happened. Let's talk about why. Now, in the world, they talk about the problem. They talk about the effects, and they spew out psychobabble junk that doesn't help anybody. But if you're going to help your children, parents, they have to believe you understand them. Many were the times sitting in visits, even with adults, where I knew exactly what I was going to hear. I knew the story going in, but I recognized I had to almost, and I probably have said this in other sermons, I had to almost just sit there and not say a word and let people tell me a story. I might get another fact or factoid or two out of it, but I knew exactly what I was going to hear, but I knew that if I cut them off and said, look, I understand, now you just got to listen, I'm in a hurry, I've got to go, if I was going to be an effective counselor, I could not reach them if they didn't think I'd heard them. And at the end, I would try to remember to say, thank you, that was very helpful. And then, if I could ask a few additional questions for clarification, to validate and confirm in their mind, wow, this minister is listening to me. He cares about what I just said. He didn't just launch into why I'm the worst sinner on the planet. And then I would ask a few questions. I knew, and I tried to be sincere, and there usually were some questions I could ask. And I knew that if I was going to reach them, they had to believe I understood the problem and could speak to it as it was. Then I could even show them off of that, now, all right, you described the problem this way. And I listened, didn't I? And is there anything else you want to say? I would often even go that far. And they'd say, no, that's it. And as soon as I would start to comment, they'd say, well, no, there's some more I want to say. And I'd stop. And I wanted to be sure they knew I was willing to listen so that they would feel understood. And then they were just wide open and they would be ready to hear. Now, they may or may not agree. And that's the problem of the past age in the church where so many didn't have God's Spirit. But I knew I had no chance of reaching them. I had no chance whatsoever if they didn't feel understood. No parent today, with the vast chasm that exists between a generation ago, even youth of 20 years ago, has any hope of understanding the extraordinary kaleidoscope of pressures and problems on kids if they don't listen and try to understand and just meditate on what's going on. A couple times I just went into a school. I just decided to walk into a school. I've done this several times. Walk into a school and just stand outside doors and look into classrooms. Now today they think you're a predator if you do that. But I would even tell the principal, I want to just go and I want to look into certain of the doors. And I would sometimes go to my own children's classroom and stand back where they couldn't see me and kind of watch what was going on. My kids are in the primary grades, but I would do it at other times. And I stopped doing it because I thought, you know, I've been to the zoo before. This is a zoo. There's no need to go. If I want to go to the zoo, I'll just go to the zoo. Wild. Unbelievable. And that's 10 and 15 years ago since I've done that, probably 15, maybe more, I'm not sure. But you have to try to understand. You have to try to understand. I mean, I had my sons write down back in the early 90s a list of rock groups. This is 15 years, well, maybe 13 years ago. I'm not even going to explain what they all mean, and they're much worse today, but listen to the kinds of rock bands that exist out there. My sons wrote these down. Ready? Here we go. Shockbox, Lynch Mob, Sister Machine Gun. These are rock groups. Nine Inch Nails, Thrill Kill Cult, DOA, stands for Dead on Arrival, Suicidal Tendencies, Old Dirty Bastard, Metal Massacre, New Idol Son, Zap Mama, Burning Spear, Poison, Megadeth, Iron Maiden, Life of Agony, Internal Bleeding, Chainsaw Kittens, Lunachicks, Alice in Chains, Total Sexual Freedom, Porno for Pyros, Body Count, 7 Year Bitch, Grave Diggers, House of Pain, Lords of the Underground, Mad Cobra, Naughty by Nature, Public Enemy, Meat Puppets, Morphine, 10,000 Maniacs. Sounds like just a study in wholesomeness, all of this, isn't it? Violent Femmes, Widespread Panic, Black Sabbath, Bad Company, Beastie Boys, Black Sheep, Boogie Monsters, Dream Warriors, 38 Special, Arrested Development, Massive Attack, The Monoxides, and then various others, Digital Underground, Slaughter, Overkill, Ugly Kid Joe, Skid Row, Marauder, Napalm Death. Is this a sick world? Then some of the different names of songs. Sex Packets, Mass Slaughter, Horror Scope, Menace to Sobriety, Subhuman Race, Master Killer, From Enslavement to Obliteration, Utopia Banished, Fear, Emptiness, and Despair. Isn't that a wonderful song title? Greed Killing, Oddities, Abnormalities, and Curiosities, sung by a group called Circle Jerks. Monster Voodoo Machine, that's a group, I guess. Suffer System, Filth and Fury, Psycho City, Sex Pistols, and on it goes. And you know what? Kids today would laugh. They'd say, oh, that's tame. Are you kidding? Let me tell you about it today. So, if you're going to help young people, you better understand. And that's why I gave a sermon some years ago. And all you new parents, I hope you're aware of it, called The Perfect Storm, because your kids are in it. I wouldn't know how to have kids today. It'd be so difficult in so many ways. Some of the stuff that's discussed in classrooms, in writing class, creative writing class is about suicide, about demon-possessed kids, about a dirty, ugly child who lived in a cornfield, and when it decided to take a bath, it washed all the dirt off and washed itself away. What do you think that means, young people? I mean, some of the stuff that I have heard that goes on in schools by people who are standing in the front of the classroom who belong in a padded cell under medication, and they're allowed to teach, and they're teaching our youth. Okay, kids, here's one for you. Children and teens, God always blesses obedience and morality. Always. God always blesses obedience and morality. Turn to Proverbs 30 and verse 11. Proverbs 30 and verse 11. There is a generation that curses their father and does not bless their mother. There's a generation that's pure in their own eyes and yet is not washed from their filthiness. There's a generation, oh, how lofty are their eyes, and their eyelids are lifted up, whose teeth are as swords, and their jaw teeth as knives, to devour the poor from off the earth and the needy from among men. Well, that's today's generation in many regards. 15 years ago, 65% of all high school students admitted they would cheat. Today, it's near 90% admitted, given the opportunity, they would cheat. Where are they learning this? 15 years ago, 21% of elementary kids said they would cheat if they could. Yet 15 years ago, 82% said they believed there was a God, and 40% prayed. And today, the number who believe there's a God is higher. It's near 90%, and a larger number of teenagers pray, but it's the wrong God, and it's not translating into conduct because they're more dishonest than ever. They're involved in more filth and garbage than ever. It's not translating. They're pure in their own eyes. They don't get off their knees or believe that this God exists and turn around and do anything about it. It doesn't translate. It has no meaning to them. And there certainly aren't preachers out there telling them to change, because the deacons will bring somebody else in who will tell them about love, grace, mercy, and compassion. That's why we're going to be disliked in many regards when we talk in terms of warnings. The ministers of this world are not teaching young people. They're not teaching all of America that punishment came because we're sinning. We're doing things that are wrong. We must obey God. Because they know if they did that, they'd be unemployed right now by the people who they need to please with what they want to hear instead of what they need to hear. The level of disrespect that is out there is astonishing. The crime, the theft, the fornication, the lying, the kinds of things that's going on, that are going on, including those things about sex practices, are simply astonishing. They're so widespread, that it's almost incomprehensible, because nobody connects cause and effect, blessings with obedience, and problems and disease and pain and emotional hurt and trauma with immorality and sin. Parents, be sure you're teaching your children, and children, understand that God will bless you if you resist the things that are going on all around you. I want our young people around the world to hear that their headquarters understands, and I believe your parents understand. We know you are in a much tougher generation than the world has ever seen before, unless possibly we could compare it to Sodom and Gomorrah in the time of the flood and Noah. It is simply astounding. Let me read an article to you about gangs again. It comes from USA Today some years ago in Tyler, Texas, which is near Big Sandy, where the college was. And it talks about what's happening to young people today. Ruth Blake, who's being quoted here, was a Smith County prosecutor in 1982 when most juvenile offenses were theft and burglary. Now, as a juvenile court judge, she deals with aggravated assault, rapes, and attempted murders. Now, this is maybe 10, 12 years ago. I can tell which ones are in gangs. Listen to this. It's instructive. Their faces and eyes are different. Their faces do not show any kind of emotion, and their eyes have no lights. They're like doll's eyes. They look dead. And that's in a juvenile system when you're used to seeing rage and pain. They're angry, you know, they just stand there dead. They don't feel anything. Well, I guess if you get into the gang because you have to run over somebody and then prove you have the courage to back over a helpless person lying on the ground, be sure they're dead, or be willing to pull a trigger on some innocent person who happens to be standing at the street corner where the driver of the gang's car throws it open and the girl says, "I'm tough," boom, boom, and shoots somebody who has no possible way of knowing that they're going to be the victim of a drive-by shooting, and that two or three little kids are going to not have a mommy or daddy that night so some girl could get in a gang. I guess there wouldn't be any lights in their eyes. Be different, young people. Truly be different. Don't be like the generation described. Point number five. To parents, hope you're all taking notes. You ought to have your pen out and your Bible open and taking notes. Both nurture and admonition are administered by both father and mother. Both nurture and admonition are administered by both father and mother. Never should there be a time, "Well, that's your son, you take care. That's your daughter, you take..." No. Turn to Ephesians chapter 6. There is a partnership. Your children need to understand. They cannot divide their parents. They speak with one voice. There's absolute unity. Look, the reason the church is in a mess today, brethren, is because the leaders can't agree. And there's a lot of people who get upset. They say, well, you know, the leaders can't agree, and that's dividing us. Well, people don't agree either. The children aren't going to agree if the parents don't agree. And so it is with the splinter leaders. Well, it's no different in a family. It's absolutely no different. Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians 6 says this, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, you know, that your days will be long on the land. It may be well with you, and you may live long on the earth. And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Now the admonition would be the punishment. The nurturing is the teaching. Both parents need to do both. They simply need to do both. Be sure to communicate with one another. Remember if Hebrews 13, I believe, 15 and 16, verse 16, to communicate and, you know, do good and so forth, forget not. Communicate with your children. Be sure they understand what is expected of them and what will happen if they don't do it, what will happen if they do do it. Both parents speak together. Do both things together. One is not the loving parent, the mom who's, I can't spank my kids. I do that. I let him do the spanking because he's better at that. Oh, I wish I had a nickel for every parental counseling I was sitting there where I would hear the mother say, oh, I'm not against spanking. I just can't do it. I have him do it. Well, guess what? You're telling the children that all of the punishment is going to come from the father. If they want love and consolation, quote unquote, love, they come to you. He's the bad guy. That's a cowardly act. I've said that to mothers. I've actually seen it the other way, too. I've seen the women will do all the spanking. The dad says, well, I come home, and I've been gone all day. I don't want to just walk in the door and spank them. So just as the mother shouldn't wait for the spanking, the end of the day, when your father gets home, he'll deal with this. And then he comes home. He's happy, had a great day at the office. And my mother would sometimes say, Randall, all three of them need a spanking. He'd been gone 3 days. He didn't feel like that. And of course, sometimes, you know, she would give the spankings too. But at the same time, you need to back each other up. You need to do some, moms. Dads, you need to do some. You can't push it all off. Say, well, I'm gone all day. I'll just have mom do it all. Doesn't work that way. And it has to be united. We can't go to the Father for love and consolation, and that Christ punishes the church. Father says, well, you come to me now. Now, I realize it's father and son, not husband and wife, but I'm using the analogy. One's a father, and Christ is a different member of the family. We can't go to the family of God and get one sense of judgment when we're down and we're out and we're encouraged and we're discouraged. We go to the Father in prayer, and every time Christ comes, oh, here comes Christ. I'm about to get a spanking. It can't be that way. They're absolutely unified. I and my Father are one. And there has to be that unity between parents. All right, point six, children and teens. Remember your parents love you and want to be proud of you in a right way. Maybe you could say satisfied or pleased. That's why I say proud of you in a right way. I know the verse is about pride. Try to never hurt them. Remember, your parents love you and want to be proud of you in a right way. Try to never hurt them. God was grieved. He was grieved when he had to destroy all life on earth. It hurt him. He wasn't happy to send fire and brimstone. Yes, he was angry, no doubt. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, God was hurt at the death of all those people. God has no pleasure in the death of the wicked, he says. None. It hurts him. God was grieved at what men did, and then after he destroyed all mankind at the time of the flood, he was grieved again and created the rainbow so that the world would know he would never do that again. In some ways, God, I believe, I don't know this, I've heard it speculated before, long ago, God may have actually seen in human nature things that he was not himself prepared for in free moral agents. Remember, all through the prophets, you find that God says, when you offered your children to the fire, those things never came into my mind, God said over and never crossed my mind you would burn your little kids to false gods. He says it over and over. It's possible God can hurt because he sees things in these little free moral agents that grow up to be adults, still specks in God's eyes, and it hurts him. You parents are no different. Children, your parents are no different. You can hurt God. You can hurt them by your conduct. You need to be aware of that. Never say, "I hate you." Psychologists will say, now when your child says, "I hate you," understand that child is in a mood. Sounds like a cow. They're having a mood. Walk away from the room. Leave the room. That's what they'll say. Or some psychologists will say, in order to teach your children not to hate you, run get a pillow, and when they're shouting they hate you, tell them to punch the pillow so it's directed toward the pillow. You can't make that stuff up. That's exactly what's happening. I'd like to read to you. I asked a group of teenagers to write down why they should honor their parents. Years and years ago, I had them write it down. These are my notes from years ago. I can't remember when I did it. Maybe 25 years ago, I would guess, 1980 or 81, and here's what they all did. I said, I want you to write down all the reasons why you should honor your parents. And here's what they wrote. Honoring my parents is the promised reward of long life, and that's why I should do it. Here's another one. It reinforces the idea of government from the top down. That's why I should honor my parents. We learn to operate under authority. Another one wrote, I'm thankful to my father for the confidence because they back me up and give me confidence. Here's another one. Their confidence in me and my abilities makes it easier to honor them. Another one. Their pride in me when I feel that I've done well. I feel great. Another one wrote, I'm thankful for their chauffeur service for the many years before I drove. Well, that was an honest kid, all right? I thought, I'll write them all down here. Honoring my parents helps me reciprocate the love they have for me and helps me to understand the love God has for me as well. Honoring my parents is a way for me to show faith in them and to better understand having faith in my Father in heaven. Pretty solid thoughts some of these kids came up with. It's a generation ago. Honoring my parents shows me that I know my position in the family. Pretty good. To teach me the respect of all elders. Here's another one. They gave me, and here's another one, they give me money. You got to hear it for honesty. Here's another one. They teach me how to make and to be a good friend. Another one, they encourage me when I feel disappointed and unhappy with myself. They taught me how to serve and help other people. Another one, when they need it. Here's another one. Honor should be given to parents for teaching us God's way of life, the right and only way. Another one wrote, to maintain the family name. Another one wrote, for health, they've taken care of us and given us the right foods. And for their presence, they're always there when I needed them. Another, for the responsibilities they take on for my sake, such as the responsibility of being my parent. I thank them for making me their child. In itself, it's a great blessing. That's a different one. I honor them because we can sit down and talk out problems. Another, they taught me to be independent and to work for my money. Another reason, they correct me in love when I'm wrong. And another, they taught me how to appreciate God's creation. Another, finally, they brought me up in God's church. You know, you young people ought to sit down and think of all the reasons you should honor your parents all over the world. I hope you will do that. What things would you come up with? Probably some of the same. You don't come up with different ones. Which ones did, kind of grabbed you as you heard them? All right. Final point to everyone. This is to families, not to parents or children, but to both. All of you draw together in crises. All of you draw together in crises. 90% of all couples who suffer the death of a child get divorced. Did you know that? 90%. The only time I ever saw up close a couple lose a child, a drunk hit and killed their beautiful little 7-year-old blonde gal, cute little thing, just destroyed the marriage. And they divorced. It's the only time I ever saw it, but I just read the statistic not long ago, I think about 10 days ago. Draw together in crises. Well, obviously, the death of a child, which in most cases, maybe there could be some case where it's the one parent or the other's fault. No parent would ever want to do it other than just murder. But it destroys the parents. It shouldn't destroy the parents if one did it by accident, the marriage, I mean. In some cases, there's suicide involved. We are all part of the body of Christ. We draw together as head and feet and eyes and ears and mouth and arms and legs and so forth. You know all the body parts that the Bible talks about. We are all members one of another as a church. We have to draw together. Well, brethren, all of you within your own family draw together in crises, the whole church in crises. Think of the crises that the church as a great family is going to go through in the years to come. Think of the crises that individual families in God's church are going to go through in years to come. Think of what happened in New Orleans when that terrible crisis struck. Predators drove in from all over the United States looking to get in on the looting. All kinds of people have set up scams to contribute to funds that are non-existent except to go into the pocket of a thief because they know everybody is grieving nationally. People showing up at shelters saying they survived New Orleans and they're from New Hampshire, you see, and so forth. You can't imagine the stories except you're probably hearing them and therefore you can imagine. Crises are going to test this nation. They're going to be testing regions, testing cities. They're going to test the church. They're going to test God's people. They're going to test your individual family. Draw close together. Proverbs 17 and verse 17 says this, a friend loves at all times and a brother is born for adversity. How true that is. You know, when there's adversity, families are supposed to lock down together. Fight for your family, people of God. Battle for your family. There's forces all around you. You're surrounded by predators. Every kind of snake and viper. Every kind of wolf. Every kind of predator, two-legged and otherwise, that are out there. Just listening, by the way, down to New Orleans last night, one man talked about the sheer problem with wild, hungry dogs attacking people because they couldn't find any food. I wonder when we think of what's coming. Only the most strong and united families will stand together. The church as a whole, yes, of course, but we're talking about individual families. Practice when there's difficulty, locking together, standing with each other, backing each other up. I hope the staff does that. We're trying to learn that together. We've been through a lot together. Brothers are born for adversity. Every time you go through difficulty, see it as an opportunity to get stronger, to develop and display loyalty. All of you should sit and talk together from time to time, occasionally with the grandparents around if you live nearby. There shouldn't be a false loyalty either. It can't be the kind of loyalty where the clan of the family comes ahead of God's people and God's church. It's got to be a right, balanced togetherness, understanding that it's underneath what we read in Matthew 10 about who we confess and who we deny. Now, these points are not always going to be easy to apply. I mean, there's no question about that. You know, they aren't. You're going to have difficulties in your family. You're going to have people in your family that are impossible to live with, to get along with. You know, if grandma's a gun runner, stay away from her, all right? If she's got a still in the backyard, stay away from her. I'm having fun, could be grandpa too. But there are going to be problems. You have to learn to be a peacemaker. You have to work at making your family work. Of course, the rewards of doing that are tremendous. When you look at what happens to homes that break up, where there's divorce, it's been demonstrated that there are higher suicide rates with the children. As a matter of fact, this week, a young girl was seen by one of the teenagers here in the congregation being wheeled in a wheelchair by the principal at the local high school here, and she had pantyhose wrapped around her neck and a red ring and perhaps had tried to commit suicide, as a couple other students did recently here at Wadsworth High School. But divorce also yields greater mental problems, greater school dropout and failure rate, higher rates of poverty, And of course, just general failure in life, it's been demonstrated, comes from families in most cases, many cases, where there has been a breakup of the home. Here's a fascinating quote, a sickening quote, but what a statement about our society and the way it lampoons families and trivializes the crucifixion. It comes from a column, and it's talking about a writer who commented on the movie The Last Temptation of Christ that came out some years ago. And the article begins, "What did you like best in the movie The Last Temptation of Christ?" asks cartoonist Edward Sorrell in his recent drawing entitled Jesus in Hollywood. Sorrell answers his own question like this, quote, "Jesus imagining what it would be like to have a wife, children, and a mortgage, and choosing crucifixion instead." How that lampoons the family and trivializes the greatest single act of love the universe has ever seen, Christ's crucifixion. But it does show how most view the family today and why the family is under assault and in such terrible decline, but it need not be so among God's people. So in conclusion, please use these principles and experience the joy that God intends us to share, that of being part of a right and godly family in a truly godless world.